Well, it is my great pleasure this week to interview Terry Linfall. And Terry, we met in Vienna not too long ago. And what a dream to interview you, because of course you work, as I do, in the field of religion and film.
I'd read many of your works and books and everything else. And so just to come and see kind of an incarnational form of you was delightful.
And Milja, who set up the meeting in the workshop in Vienna, was saying, you know that Terry's going to come. And she was like, if you're having second thoughts about whether you could take the time out during a busy term, she said, Terry is coming all the way from the States. And of course, I thought, well, I'm only coming from Canterbury. So actually, I think I really had better come. And it was a real pleasure to meet you.
My pleasure as well.
Yeah. And you gave a really great talk in which you really got stuck into Hollywood history. And do you want to say a little bit about your, to begin with anyway, your work in the area of theology and film?
Yeah, basically, I went from college into seminary, and in seminary, I had a professor who taught film, Mel White, and I began to realize, looking at some of these historical films, that there is so much religion that is there and so many kind of theological themes that they're dealing with. And so to me, history became key more than theology, because you could find theology changing throughout history. And so I want to go back to the roots. I want to go back and say, what is our tradition? And looking at it, not only from kind of secular religious films, but also what have Christians tried to do in the media? And so that took us all the way back to dealing with icons and parables and everything else, and then how that translated into film.
Yeah, and this is something that you did at Fuller, is that right, as well, back in, I don't know how long ago that was, but yeah, with Rob Johnston.
I was just basically at Fuller playing basketball and doing what I could to kind of get through. My Greek and Hebrew was off on the side more than anything else. I was more interested in popular culture. But from Fuller, I never felt a call into the ministry itself. The mantle was too heavy. And I wanted to go where you could make things up, like in Tim Burton's Big Fish. How can you tell stories? And I thought teaching is perfect. So I went to the University of Southern California and finished my PhD there. And so that brought me together with all kinds of communication media and film and the ideas. And so USC was my kind of card into studying both history, theology, film, and communication.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to when I was doing my theology degree in the UK in the 1990s, and we never did anything like this. And that was why I think, you know, some of my contemporaries were like, they really wanted to do a PhD, but it was a case of, you know, what area shall I do? Whereas for me, there was no question that it had to be in this area, because my love of film was starting to really emerge. I hardly ever went to the cinema before I went to university. And I was doing this degree in theology, but I was kind of aware, not so much the double life, but it was more that there were certain things I was doing in the classroom and writing my essays and all the sort of academic study. And then the love of film, and they belonged in two very different spaces. And I think I've always been interested in this breaking down of the boundaries and the binaries between the sacred and the secular, for example. So the film work sort of at that particular point in the mid to late 90s, you know, kind of felt like the right project to be working on. And then you've just given a very wonderful illustration of how you thought that needs to operate outside of the academy.
Yeah. And I think what was amazing that I was in seminary in the early 70s. And so there was this movement to kind of engage not only in the environment, there was a sense of theology and ecology back there in the 70s, but also this kind of excursion into the arts. And I think both of us were very much influenced by Christ and Culture, Niebuhr's book. And so we saw things in those kind of categories, but that was just the beginning. And since then, things waned for a while. And then they've come back in the 90s and until today, people are publishing in so many different ways in religion and film.
Yeah, and I found that with Edrich Niebuhr's Christ and Culture, that although it was written in 1952 and doesn't talk about film, it's actually the benchmark for all the subsequent work. In fact, I think it's probably quoted more than any other single work over the last...
There's a book by Deasy somewhere, I think, that really has just dominated. Chris Deasy has taken over the Christ and Culture. I'm kidding. I'm poking you.
I might use that particular quote on a loop, and I could put it at the start of all my interviews and all my, and say to my students, there we are, here we are. I'm not going to disagree with
you. You supplanted him.
No, but I mean, so the work that you're doing is phenomenal, because what I really found and picked up from what you were doing at the workshop in Vienna is that you're looking at all those sort of things from the 1920s, 30s, 40s, the period around, well, where censorship and the church and the relationship of the church and the influence that they had in determining which films could be shown, which films were seen, and then taking that forward and using that as a template very much for the way in which this interaction between religion and film follows a number of different pathways.
Yeah, I was always curious because people always talked about how the church was against film. And it just didn't set right, because I realized, I think the church is always on the vanguard of a lot of media, from Gutenberg and radio. And so I said, what was the church doing in film? And so I and my graduate students would start going over to the Library of Congress and really digging into the archives of these old, not only kind of motion picture magazines, which were very religious as well. I mean, there were columns on movies for church. I mean, every issue coming out and telling you how to use the church. But many of the religious magazines, like the Congregationalist, would devote whole issues in the 19-teens to the motion picture, the photoplay, and say, how do we use this? And so you have people like Religious Possibilities of the Motion Picture. Okay. Yeah, Herbert Jump just basically wrote his pamphlet in 1911, really the first document, the first text on film before Munsterberg's Psychology and Lindsay's kind of Art of the Motion Picture. This came out first. And he said, essentially, the church can use and should be using films because they tell parables. And so you have the parable of the Good Samaritan, the prodigal son. I mean, you could make them adventure stories. And so he really kind of scripted how you could write screen scenarios and use them for the church. And then I began to realize that in the 1919, the Methodist had a centenary of 100,000 people in Ohio, and they showed thousands of films. And Eastman Kodak gave kind of film projectors to everybody. Presbyterian Church took 2,000 projectors to their churches. I found a local kind of Episcopal church here that I went up into their attic, and they didn't realize they had a 1919 projector up in their attic that was still in pristine condition, and they didn't even realize it was there. And so even the Episcopal, so they would kind of broadcast things on walls like people do in contemporary worship today. And you could sing the songs or the choruses, the hymns at that time, or you could see these kind of short little messages, these parables on film.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking that you, with your students now, you screen films, you show films, you know, you don't just sort of say, watch this film and write a review or you know, write an essay on it. But actually the watching of the film and the deconstruction of the film is actually central to your pedagogy.
It is very key. When I do teach kind of film courses, that's what we do. And we could, I mean, I got this from Roger Ebert up at the University Film Festival in Virginia. And you would go kind of almost scene by scene. And then you stop the scene. You talk about it and say, what's going on here? What do we see? What are the kind of camera angles? What's the lighting? What is the dialogue saying? What's the position of characters? And then you begin to say, are there any kind of hints of the divine in any of this? Do we see any parts of scripture kind of coming in? And so people are, this is what I taught in graduate school at Regent University. I'm now at an undergraduate place where there are wonderfully biblically illiterate and cinematically illiterate. They don't know the stories of the gospel. I mean, most people couldn't tell you who a disciple was, the students I'm dealing with now. And they couldn't tell you any films before 2000. I mean, some of them haven't even seen Indiana Jones, the kind of original, or Star Wars. They have no idea. And so it's a whole new kind of generation that you're opening up. I use Pixar films more than anything now on what I'm doing. But yeah, we would kind of break down the films that way. And when I first started teaching, we used 16 millimeter. And so we'd have to put the reels on and just, it was delightful, because sometimes if we didn't have a take-up reel, all the kind of celluloid would fall on the floor and it took a long time to kind of re-reel it. But those were times where you just really got together. You stayed late with students and watched and talked and debated what you saw.
Yeah. And you mentioned Roger Ebert there. And I found his film reviews to be so detailed, so sophisticated, and actually so enriching. I'm just thinking of when he reviewed Taxi Driver in the 70s, and that was so much the foundation for, you know, at a time when a lot of the religion and film works that are now, you know, obviously some, you know, I've contributed to that discourse, but at a time when I was doing my PhD in the 90s and they weren't really there, it was going back to reviewers like him and authors like John May as well. And I found that they were completely on that kind of wavelength and were able to sort of say some of the sort of things that I was trying to work through academically. But of course, although he passed away, obviously, very sadly, a decade or so ago, it's lovely to see on the Chicago Sun-Times pages, the Roger Ebert reviews written in the style of Roger Ebert. And I don't know how it is, because I'm not sure I could, because I have my own style of writing reviews, but it's almost as though they are really channeling Roger Ebert, and I find that such a testament to him.
In Chicago, they hold quite a few seances, okay, and they just kind of call the spirit of Roger Ebert. So, but I'm indebted to him too for a project that I just finished, the Virginia Film Festival with Bob Ghazali, who is now head of the American Film Institute. Bob Ghazali had invited me up for many kind of festivals. But then one festival, Roger Ebert was supposed to do his kind of session, but he couldn't show up because he got ill. And so they called me to come and say, Terry, could you do any kind of program? We've got to fill in really quickly. You've got a month. And I said, well, okay. So that's when I first did this whole series on prayer in Hollywood movies. And I began to say, okay, I've seen prayers everywhere from Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, to Meet the Parents, and Talladega Nights, Hacksaw Ridge. And what are these prayers saying? So I got together some former students and some friends, and we put together this feature documentary on Hollywood Teach Us to Pray, and to look at how prayer is depicted in film and what people are saying about it. And we interviewed some great directors like Roger Benton, who did Places in the Heart, Kramer versus Kramer, David Anspaugh, who did Hoosiers and Rudy, Michael Schultz, who did Coolie High and Which Way Is Up, and a lot of the Car Wash, a lot of the kind of Richard Pryor movies. And so these directors were able to give us kind of insights in what they were trying to say and do with prayers in their film. And Helen Prejean, who wrote Dead Man Walking, a wonderful interview with her and Father James Martin from America Magazine. All of these people kind of coming together and looking and trying to analyze hundreds of prayers that we had put together. So it's because of Roger Ebert that we actually kind of made this film eventually.
Yeah, and you mentioned Robert Benton a moment ago, and actually a film of his, I'm sure you're familiar with it, but one that got a very minor release, it was virtually straight to video in the UK, was Nobody's Fool, from the Richard Russo book, and that always ranks very highly. And it's one of those sort of things, when people say to me, what's your favourite film? There's obviously, sometimes I mentioned the Scorsese ones, and there's, you know, a couple of Hitchcock in there as well, and those are the sort of ones you'd expect me to say, maybe The Apartment as well, but Nobody's Fool, with such a little-known film, but with such a fantastic cast, including, of course, the late Paul Newman. And it's one of those films that works at a very slow pace, and I kind of feel that it's almost affecting me because of the emotional level. There's so much going on in there. And in a world where all these Marvel films and so on, which I sometimes feel I go to out of a sense of duty, you know, turning around to those films and Robert Benton's work, just phenomenal and kind of really just a very gentle sort of type of filmmaking where not very much happens, but everything happens at the same time.
Well, in our interview with him, it was just wonderful. It was during COVID. So he was stuck in a compartment in New York, and it's very scratchy because he's elderly, but he's just so articulate and so insightful. And he began to talk about Places in the Heart that just really kind of overwhelmed us. He said he started with that final scene that many people have never understood. It's the Eucharist scene in the church, this old Baptist church, and they're passing the elements around. And you have the dead and the living there together. You have KKK members and Black kind of Christians. And he said, as a Christian, and he is kind of he calls himself a rural Christian rather than an urban Christian. Urban Christians are so progressive and they think they're ahead of the Gospels. Rural Christians have a humility about them and a sense of community and fellowship. And he said, I really wanted to show what the Gospel was all about and what heaven is all about. And so we started with that scene, and then I had to find a story. So I went back and created the story from that one Eucharist scene at the end. And to me, and several of the critics that we had talking about the films, they said, it's the one film that just blows you away the first time you see it if you're not expecting it. And it's just amazing.
Yeah. And what really comes through in what you're saying is that you've clearly engaged with and know personally a lot of the great film directors.
It's amazing. Yeah, these older people. And so our film. Now, if you invite me over to University of Kent, In next fall or so, I'll come with the film and I'll fly my way over. But I mean, just seeing these films, these prayers, we've shown it at a couple venues so far. And we find that people not only laugh, I mean, hilariously at certain parts, but they also weep. I mean, and they get disturbed. And they really find, they begin to kind of examine their own spiritual journey and what's going on in their prayer life and how do they talk to God. And so actually, Hollywood does teach many people how to pray. And so we go, this is amazing what is going on in this simple little film that we put together.
Yeah. And do you find that those film critics and film makers are very amenable to this discussion? I mean, obviously, Robert Benton clearly was, but do they find that kind of conversation that you and people like me are initiating really an important one? Does it sort of fit with what they're trying to disclose through their films?
I think basically many filmmakers are really taking their own cinematic spiritual journey. And so they are saying something and they're just hoping that someone catches it. And they don't. It's very much like C.S. Lewis writing the Chronicles of Narnia. Michael Ward looked back and he found this kind of hidden agenda, the Kappa Key, he called it, the secret of all the planets influencing each one of the seven Chronicles. And Lewis was so secretive, he never told even his friend Tolkien about it. But when you begin to look at the evidence that Michael Ward put together, you realize there is a great story there. And if someone had been able to sit down with Lewis and say, try to tease out of him, were you trying to do this? I think he would have shared, but people have to ask the questions. And one thing I would encourage students of film is to go and meet these older directors and begin to ask them these questions, because people want to talk and they want to share, but they don't want to appear too kind of too much bravado or chutzpah and say, look what I've done, but they want it to kind of be drawn out, deduced out of them. And that's what's so exciting about approaching some of these people. They're amazing people.
Absolutely, because I was thinking of Sarah Anson Vox, who did a lot of work on Clint Eastwood, and I know she was quite keen to know whether Clint Eastwood himself would be receptive to what she was writing. I get the sense that there was no kind of direct correspondence, but wouldn't that have been a gem? Because I mean, I found Clint Eastwood's career really fascinating, because there's often the public profile, and quite sort of in terms of his politics as well, and his filmmaking, which is so tender and often moves in a very subversive direction from sort of the Dirty Harry archetype that, you know, really is not representative of the sort of filmmaking that he's done in the last 20 or 30 years.
And that's what we felt in Clint Eastwood. His films appear regularly, I mean, really quite frequently in this documentary. And so we tried to get an interview with him and with Denzel Washington and others, but Tyler Perry, so agents will block you everywhere. That's the difficulty. If you can get through them, you can get to heaven.
Yeah. I've heard that said, actually, that sometimes the filmmakers themselves are very happy to do this, but it's their representatives who are the ones who are blocking it. And of course, the ones who might not quite understand the sort of subtlety of what we're talking right now. And that their way into the film directors is not quite the same as the passion that we have, which perhaps isn't something that is communicated so well. But tell me a bit, Terry, about your own background, because obviously film is something that I think of in relation to you. And obviously faith is plays a big part in your life. But do you want to say a little bit about your upbringing in terms of where you were born?
Yeah, I was born in Basel, Switzerland, with a twin sister. My father was studying at the University of Basel under Karl Barth, basically the day I was born. And so he had to leave class. And my mother almost died. She lost blood at Swiss Hospital back then in the 40s. Didn't have a lot of kind of high technology. And she remembers, I mean, my mom was just an ordinary, good, solid, cheerful woman. But she says the one spiritual experience, mystical experience she had, she saw herself leaving her body. And she looked down and she realized these twins were coming out. And she said, Lord, who's going to take care of them? Look at my husband. He's not going to do it. So she said, the Lord said, okay, May, go on back down and take care of these kids. And so, I mean, we're so grateful. But she has no other mystical experience but this kind of comic kind of leaving. And she was ready to go, but the Lord said, okay, you can stay. And so I was born there. Now, what is really interesting, because when you ask me these questions, I started thinking about how I am torn between these two ways. I mean, if you remember Charles Williams, he said there's the way of affirmation and the way of rejection. And the way of rejection is a way of denial. And it's something that we see under kind of Paul Schrader in his transcendental style. It's where you become ascetic. It's where you kind of discipline yourself. And it's a hard way. It's a really a way of struggle. And I think we have seen kind of in the last 20 years an emphasis upon this transcendental style that he articulates. But there is, I would argue, another transcendental style, and that is the kind of way of affirmation and celebration. And so I look at my grandparents, and on one side, on my father's side, the Lindvalls, the Swedish, come from Jönköping, Sweden, and everything else. They were kind of very severe Very ascetic and very spiritual and disciplined, kind of Pentecostals from Sweden. And we would go there at Christmas, and the highlight for being with them at Christmas was everyone would get a kind of a dessert of rice pudding, and one person would have a raisin in it, and that raisin got to hand out presents, which were never extravagant at all. But that was the greatest joy. On the other hand, my mother was a Nelson, came from the Millers and the Nelsons, coal mining family up in Clearfield, Pennsylvania. And they were more like Mikhail Bakhtin's carnival family. So instead of getting Odette and Carl Dreyer films from the Swedes, here you would get the Benny Hill. I mean, you would get these kind of British comedy where you would eat and drink and, you know, people would tell stories. It's very much like Big Fish by Tim Burton, where you tell the stories. They're so unbelievable. I had 18 aunts and uncles in this one little town. My mother was the only one of 10 children who left. And so you go back there, and this community, this fellowship was hilarious. I mean, their picnics and all of their kind of sins, and they're bragging about their sins, was so public. But it was also a way of affirmation. And so you're caught between this rice pudding and sumptuous pies, juicy berry pies, and you realize both ways are important.
Yeah, and you mentioned Tim Burton's Big Fish a few times, and isn't that the most phenomenal of films in terms of what it says about the way that we all do it to some extent, about the way that the narrative, and I guess it does fit with nostalgia as well, about that's the way in which we frame our narratives. Yeah. And often in order to tell a story, and we, you know, this is a great podcast for getting people to talk about their own backgrounds. And you've done that with a phenomenal, actually your own birth story there actually is kind of almost on a par with that of what happens at the beginning of Big Fish with, you know, Albert Finney spinning the yarn about, you know, sort of like, but you know, it's sort of like, how do you deal with literally out of body experiences, which is what, yes, your mother had, and of course the way to do that sometimes is to channel it through creativity. So as you're talking, I can start to see how film can be a really wonderful lens for being able to tell the stories in the way that perhaps in a very sort of dry, natural, biographical sense actually wouldn't quite have the same effect.
Yeah, and that's why when we get married, we have a balance to our story. So you could look at the historicity of your story and relationship, or you could look at the fantasy as you remember it. And so that's why, I mean, this whole idea of nostalgia, what you're doing with these podcasts, is hilarious. I mean, it's wonderful because it helps us to kind of rethink and then to test and to kind of check our stories and to see where have we gone wrong. That's one thing that's so amazing about the Bible. I mean, the stories do not hide any of the sins or flaws of all the patriarchs and all the people in the Bible. They present them as they are. And a friend and I just wrote a book called Old Men of the Bible. They're not getting better, they're getting older. And so we looked at the ends of lives of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, Solomon, Hezekiah. And at the end of their lives, they're drunk, they're angry, they're vindictive. They're just spiteful. And you go, what's happened? Where's sanctification? And I ask a rabbi friend of that. He says, Terry, God wants us to look at the one king, not at the kings down here. We don't look at human beings. We look beyond. And so I love that. What we have done today is we've kind of whitewashed everyone instead of letting them be sinners and saints at the same time.
Yeah, and that's something actually I talk about with my students in relation to King David. It was Eric Christiansen who did some work on the Godfather films and King David and putting them into, you know, juxtaposition. And I talk about that with my students, like, why are we drawn to flawed characters, the anti-heroes? You know, I mean, my PhD was largely looking at film noir. And it's that sort of question, why are we drawn to the underside? And you're right, it's all there. Think of, you know, often in the case of nostalgia, because I've just been writing on nostalgia and as part of the study leave I've just had, and you're looking at nostalgia and sort of, oh, it's Edenic, it's paradisical, but you're thinking, hang on, what happened in the Garden of Eden? You know, so it's actually, the seeds are there. The way we look at the past, people, you know, in my place of work today, I've spoken to a colleague who's been here, half the length of time I've been working here. She's only been here 10, I've been here nearly 20. And she was like, yeah, 10 years ago, it wasn't such a bad place. And I was thinking, well, yeah, I keep a diary. And I said, yeah, and it's just interesting because if we were to go back to those periods, you'd be able to say, gosh, those were difficult people or those were challenging times. But it's interesting how we sometimes choose to believe certain narratives because they fit where we are now. And that's our, in some ways, maybe our coping mechanism.
Yeah, I agree. I kept a journal as well during a certain period of my academic career. And it's fun to go back and look at the stories. And sometimes they're wilder then than they are even in your imagination now. But I love the kind of the Tim Burton idea of this big fish of nostalgia, of looking back and saying, okay, where have we exaggerated and where have we really undervalued what God was doing? And sometimes we miss that as well.
Yeah, and that's why it was, I think, such a clever film, because when I first saw that, I don't think I'd read any reviews of it back in 2003 or four. The first hour, I was thinking, oh, this is a bit of a tall story. It's a bit silly and all the rest of it. Second hour, I was like, this is necessary. It's like, and it's like that transition, because it starts from a place that just doesn't sort of fit. And you're thinking, why are these strange, fictitious narratives being told? As in, well, I know the answer to that, because that's what filmmaking is. But I couldn't quite buy into the story. By the end of it, I was in, you know, virtually in floods of tears. And I thought, that is exactly what we do with our own lives. And actually, I suppose you've hit the nail on the head there about this podcast, because part of me is looking for those authentic life stories. But the way we tell our own stories often entails doing so from the vantage point of where we are now. And of course, we're looking back. And of course, because we've been on a journey, and that's what we're in the process of exploring in your case, then of course, it's very easy to say, oh, well, this thread led to that thread and this happened and it was all inevitable that it would lead to that. But if you were to go back 20, 30, 40 years, you probably think, well, actually, that's, you know, there's no way I could ever have predicted I'd end up here. For example, I had no idea. I was in Basel myself just a few weeks ago while en route to Strasbourg for a conference on nostalgia. And I had no idea that that was your background. So, you know, it's suddenly straight away, you said something that's just made me think, oh, that wasn't the answer I was expecting. And everyone has that element in their lives. Nobody is predictable. Nobody, we all, you might write books that students read, but you know, there are so many bits of your life that may have led to the creation of those books, but which are unknown to the readers.
But you actually have students who read your books? That's amazing. And that's a tall tale.
And I'll tell you a story about that, because of course, sometimes, and I shouldn't do it, because I sometimes feel I should write myself out of my own module. So I put myself on the reading list, in the sense of, if I'm teaching on something, they're aware that I've contributed to that. But when they then give their class presentations, sometimes they feel the need to quote me, but they don't know how to do it. And they look, and either they don't look at me at all, or they look at me, and because all the other authors are by surname, they don't want to call me by my surname, or if they do, they feel a bit awkward and they then can't make eye contact. So I sometimes thank them afterwards and say, that was great. But also I say, you know, I feel a bit awkward because really, you know, I've made you feel a bit awkward because, you know, I'm sort of part of this narrative and I'm in the room assessing you. So there are multiple layers going on here. So the answer is I should probably write myself out of my own modules.
No, I think our job is to make them feel awkward. That's half the fun. And to tease and to kid them. I mean, students need that because it jollies them up. It really begins to loosen them when you kind of create that rapport and relationship with them where you can give them a nickname. You can kind of take some flaw they do. If they're falling asleep, just imitate them. There's something delightful in that when they realize, okay, I've been caught by my professor and he still cares for me. He still enjoys me.
And what is really coming through in what you're saying is that whereas, and certainly in Britain, I think this was the case, particularly 10 or more years ago, that the starting point was always the research. The idea is you write the books, you write the monographs, and then the students will just imbibe them because, you know, these wonderful works, and then they will process them and they will then sort of be, you know, in the presence of this great scholarship. But what you're doing, which I think is far more important, which is to put the students first. It's so obvious from what you're saying that you are where the students are. And it sounds as though, because I know you've had a very long, enriching career, but your enthusiasm is so obviously undiminished.
Well, it's fun too. I mean, because I write my books for my students. I mean, basically, a class period will be me testing a chapter. And so I'm kind of telling the chapter. I'm trying to kind of bring it to life, kind of add the anecdotes and everything else that illustrate what it's about. And if it doesn't work with the class, then I realize, okay, this chapter needs to be revised. And you realize, so if you write first for people that you're thinking of, real actual people, it changes the whole narrative that you're creating.
I'm just thinking here, though, film obviously has played a huge role, Terry, in the work that you're doing now. But is this something that you grew up with as well? Was films, or was it music, or was it literature, you know, in terms of your academic journey as well? But in terms of your personal journey growing up, did film play a big role in your life?
Very interesting question, because I grew up, my dad was an Assembly of God chaplain in the military. And so we would move around quite a bit. And the denomination looked askance at movies. Even the kind of the undergraduate Assembly of God college I went to, Vanguard University, in the 60s, they forbade us to go to movies, but I would sneak off. But when I was about 12 years old, I remember my dad bought and brought home a little projector and several 8mm cartoons, Andy Panda, Woody Woodpecker, Mighty Mouse, and I would watch those over and over again. And there were several Charlie Chaplin films involved in that. And so I had this kind of sneaky kind of guilt. Not, it wasn't guilty because my parents were so full of grace, but I knew I was doing something that was probably a little taboo for people in the denomination. But then when I was in high school and we were stationed over in Bad Kreuznach, Germany, on Sunday nights, my dad brought in these Reverend Jim Frederick films called The Life of St. Paul, and they were made as serials. So much like it, when I was a young boy, I did go to Saturday matinees, and there would be kind of Buck Rogers or Roy Rogers, you know, all these kind of cowboy and space serials. And The Life of St. Paul would end with some dramatic moment of Stephen about to be stoned, or Paul being kind of lowered out the window in Damascus. And I was just engrossed. I mean, I just so fascinated by these movies, these religious movies that told the story of the Book of Acts, that kept me so engaged. And I think that made a very strong impression on me, because then when I graduated from high school, went off to college, they said, you can't do it. But I would still sneak off with my friends to go see Night of the Living Dead in 1968 when it came out at a really naughty little theater. And so those kinds of experiences, it was forbidden, but also something that just kind of just enthralled me. Little by little, I became interested. I majored in biology and literature, and so there was no film background. But when I went to Fuller Seminary, there was a professor, Mel White, whose son, Mike White, wrote School of Rock and other films like that, Nacho Libre. And he is also the one who kind of basically has directed White Lotus today. Mike White is the son of my professor from seminary. And Mel White just got us so excited about films. I mean, we would watch and talk about them and debate them. And the other thing he did that really took me off in another trajectory was he introduced me to international animation from Zagreb Studios. When I began to look at Eastern European animation, I was just so captivated, because I thought, here are the parables kind of from the Hebrew tradition and from the Gospels. These parables are short. They're pithy. They're not feature films. They're really kind of something you can handle and then really kind of try to figure out what they're saying. And so animated films became really one of my delights. In fact, my newest book, just I'll put it up, Animated Parables, of just looking, it just came out a month ago, just looking at kind of Richard Conde here as a Canadian animator, and looking at cartoons from Japan, from England, a lot from England as well, and from different places, and dealing with the seven deadly sins. And essentially, every cartoonist that I dealt with seven deadly sins, the wages of sin is death. They all suffer. So they're so biblical in a fun sort of way. They're comic, they're short, they're pithy, they're enigmatic, and they draw us in. And so it was there in seminary that I just really found that I love movies. And as that, I went to kind of USC and studied there, but I did my dissertation on C.S. Lewis and his communication. But then I got out and I taught at a place called Azusa Pacific University. And one of the courses I taught was a team taught course on film and literature. And I was in charge of film. And so then my film career started. I came to the East Coast to start a university, which would become Regent University. And there were seven of us, very eclectic, a Black Pentecostal, a really liberal Methodist, an Episcopalian, a Presbyterian, Assembly of God, Pentecostal, all of these kind of strange people together. And the seven of us started graduate school of communication. And I was the youngest, and I was given the whole realm of film. And so I had to learn along with my students, and it was just kind of a quick learning. You have research skills, but you realize I've got to train myself and just see everything. And so students and I would drive up to Washington, D.C. 4 hours to watch something there, or at a local university, William & Mary, and just learning, teaching, watching films over and over again. It became my life for the next 40 years of research.
Yeah, and with a real passion as well. When you're doing this sort of thing, you can never stop. And I find that, I mean, I'm aware that I have lots of obsessions, and, you know, going to the cinema and writing, because the two go together, because I concretize those experiences maybe immortalize those experiences through doing a review, because that's my lens, my way into what I've watched, the impact that that's had on me. I need to do something with it. And I guess and sometimes, of course, you can put that on social media, or you can share it with people face to face or with your students. But sometimes having a record of that, and if you watch lots of films, then you get to the point where you don't really remember very easily. You might think, oh, I saw it 2 weeks ago, and oh, I can't quite. Somebody refers to the ending, and you're like, oh, I need to go back onto that. So at least having a review gives you enough of a steer into that, and then you can refer to it and use it for subsequent sort of work. But it sounds like in your case, that's something that you've been doing as a lifelong project. And it sounds as though you're still doing all of that now. And I don't know if you've sort of noticed a change and evolution in the sort of the type of films that are being made, the type of films that you're interested in, whether you go back to lots of older films, as I know you did in the presentation that I saw you give, for example, in Vienna. I don't know whether you sort of go back and sort of find that revisiting Hollywood history actually is an important way of making today's students aware of the multiplicity of ways of, for example, doing theology through film.
Yeah, I think you're very kind of discerning on that. I love kind of history. I think the one genre of film, not even a genre, the one kind of film that I really stay up with are animated films, yeah. More than anything else, and comedies. I have fallen off in my movie going ever since COVID. I mean, I rarely go back. And I don't watch them on television, so or even Blu-ray. Every now and then something's recommended that I'll go see. But for my students, I have to kind of see certain films that you bring in. But otherwise, I'm doing a lot more reading and watching animated films. Yeah. So it's a change. You find yourself kind of being moved. I think one of the major events that changed this was I taught at Regent University for 25 years and then was fired. And basically kind of by a Haman, as I like to call him, who kind of really slandered me. And it was at first kind of a very kind of a shocking moment for my wife and myself, who had kind of really been established. We had young kids at then. And so we didn't know what we were going to do. So I got a job teaching at Duke University down in North Carolina, commuted down there for a year, then a job at William & Mary, College of William & Mary, named after, of course, your king and queen from many years ago, and got to teach there for a year. And then a local other university, small university, hired me, kind of endowed a chair there. But when we were fired, we didn't know what was going to happen. When I came to Virginia Wesleyan University, they gave me half an appointment in religious studies, which I hadn't been in since seminary, and half in communication and film. And what that did was really change a lot of my research interests. When I taught church history, I began to find that there was so much of interest to me, particularly humor. And so forget this other plug too, but the other book that really kind of changed anything in studying church history, I looked at what did people say about laughter? And so I kind of created this book called God Mocks. Looks like it's inside upside down or something, who knows, but God Mocks, and it's just a history of satire through church history. If I had never been fired, I never would have written that book for New York University Press. And so you realize maybe some of the worst moments of your life are also the best. Yeah. They open up opportunities that you never expected. And my wife really believed that God was directing our paths. I had more doubt than she did. But her faith in kind of the sovereignty of God, the care of God, was something that sustained us through that whole time. And it just opened up all new kinds of opportunities.
Yeah. And actually, you've actually answered a question that I would have asked a bit later in this interview, which is when I ask in most of my interviews, which is about whether we can be nostalgic about negative experiences. And I think actually, in terms of what you've just said, you've hit the nail on the head, because this whole notion of looking back that we've been discussing, I think, is predicated sometimes on a present focus, a sense of where we are now, and perhaps the feeling of loss in the present, which is causing us maybe to revisit where we've been. Maybe we can rebuild that past, or maybe the future, the eschatological element, is also a matter of rebuilding what we think Eden was once like. So nostalgia is as much about the present and future as it is the past. But actually, that question about whether then we can be nostalgic about things that didn't go right, and maybe actually try and change the orientation, which you've done there through humor. So you turned something that was obviously horrible, patently obviously horrible, but you turned that into a positive. You turned it into comedy, and literally so.
My parents gave me that gift. I mean, to see things from a comic perspective. You can see things really from a tragic perspective or a comic perspective. And we've all chosen the comic. I mean, it's one of the great discoveries of that and great affirmations of that was when you're in college and a woman breaks your heart. you realized you thought this was the woman for me. And so you look at that, and then 20 years later, you meet her and you go, oh my Lord, you saved me from a shrew, someone that would have made my life just miserable, you know, and you thank God even so much. And I was, halfway through my life's journey, as Dante was, I found myself at 35. I was still unmarried and met kind of the woman of my dreams, tall, statuesque, beautiful Karen Garbus. And essentially, she gave me tall children, like my son back here. He gave that to his mother for Mother's Day. So he would always be around, even though he's on the West Coast. He's a comedy writer out there. So it's fun to have him kind of hiding around the house. But
it's worth just saying, because obviously this is an audio podcast, but I love what I'm watching. And I feel I should use this still for the interview, because right behind you, you've got is it a cardboard cutout of your son?
It's a cardboard cutout of my son that he sent to us. And he's got his high five and he's wearing the pinstripe seersucker that I always wear. And so just kind of have fun. Our daughter lives locally and she's going to make us grandparents for the first time this August. So I'm 75 and going to be a grandfather finally. You know, it took time, but we got there. I got married at 35 and now grandparent here. So we just look back and some of the tough times you realize when you go through a miscarriage and early in your marriage, you go, what's going on? And then you get two wonderful children and you realize the blessings that God has poured out. And you needed to go through that kind of crisis. You need to go through the valleys. And if you haven't, you don't really appreciate all the gifts that are there.
That is so well told, obviously, because I think I have tried to follow through on that route in terms of sometimes revisiting the people from the past and the people who may, and the people who are often central in your life, so say at university, are perhaps less so now, but some of the more peripheral characters tend to take center stage. And there's a whole area about, you know, re-meeting people that maybe one either did have or wanted to have a relationship with. And I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head, because sometimes you might still be thinking, oh, that person hasn't changed at all. Or in many cases, you think they may not have changed very much, but you see them in a different light, because when they're not there, and this is nostalgia all over, when you've been wondering before Facebook, before social media, what is that person doing now? You imagine them as unchanged. You imagine them as they were when you last saw them at the age of 20 or 21 or whatever it may be. Then you see them again. And then, of course, you start to think, you know, hang on, actually, the things that you're telling me are on a kind of continuum with all the things I guessed and knew about you back then. And then you realize that maybe what might in the abstract have been a perfect, wonderful marriage, if you'd gone down that path, actually wouldn't have worked out. And so it's like those films, and it's something very Scrooge-like in this, but that Nicolas Cage film from 2000 where he suddenly wakes up one morning on Christmas Day and he's got this family that he didn't have, and he's sort of like, you know, you've got that sort of notion of somebody who is like given a glimpse of a different life, and then you realize that you can go back and correct all those nostalgias, you can, you know, all those different sort of what if moments, and actually it says a lot more about you, perhaps more about you than it does about the person who you've put on a pedestal and are objectifying.
Yeah, and C.S. Lewis has a great idea that at the end of time, God's grace will come back to all those wounds, and those wounds become scars that you tell stories about, and they're wonderful scars. You're so proud of all these scars that you've received through your life, because they have made you who God wanted you to be. And so it's really kind of an exciting way to look at when you're going through kind of a temptation, a trial or something, that there's something good in this and you've got to keep your eyes open for it. I try to tell my students that final exams are that way, but they haven't believed me yet.
Yeah. Well, and of course, actually you mentioned C.S. Lewis, and of course you are. Do you want to say a bit about the chair that you've held on the C.S. Lewis professorship?
It's the C.S. Lewis chair, endowed chair of Christianity and, I mean, of communication and Christian thought. I just have one Christian thought, so that they didn't put thoughts that are there. But it really was an honor. A friend of mine came to this university when I basically was in the gutter looking for a job in different places. And he came to the president of this Virginia Wesleyan, and he said, Billy, if you take Terry, I'll give you $1 million. And Billy said, welcome, Terry. He said, come on in. And so the donor, he didn't want to put his name on it. So we said, well, what do we have in common? And we both kind of really enjoyed kind of talking about and reading Lewis. And so he said, let's just call it the C.S. Lewis. So I checked with Doug Gresham and others with the C.S. Lewis Foundation, and it became acceptable. And so the first book I wrote was on C.S. Lewis's theory of laughter. It's called Surprised by Laughter, the comic world of C.S. Lewis. And so it was really fun. So it's his kind of approach to life has really kind of shaped mine as well. But then the great thing he did, Lewis always made me smile, but he directed me to Chesterton, who makes me laugh. Chesterton, this 300-pound kind of journalist from Fleet Street, is just an amazing, hilarious person. And he's so topsy-turvy in his thinking that he makes us readjust and get things in a different perspective. And I love having this kind of different perspective, comic perspectives, that these Christian authors, so many of them, going back to Erasmus and going to even Sir Thomas More and Luther, they all use humor in a way that you go, I have always looked at the faith so solemnly. I think one little kind of addendum to this is that a friend, Rabbi Leon Klonecki, a rabbi from New York, he said, Terry, said, the problem with you Protestants is that you read your scriptures so solemnly, you know, so dully. You sound like a Southerner, and it's very important. He says, you should try a Jewish accent. You know, read Jewish Jesus in a Jewish accent, and suddenly the humor comes out. Hey, you got something in your eye? It's a log, you know? And there's this kind of playfulness that we have kind of approached sacred things with too much of solemnity and not really allowed the joy and the comedy to come out of them. And so that's something that kind of really has shaped my understanding of not only the Bible, but of life.
Yeah, and those juxtapositions are important, because sometimes it's very hard, particularly when you're dealing with people who are suffering from grief, or, you know, somebody's ill or experiencing the passing of a family member or friend. And I think in those sort of situations, you it's difficult to navigate, because you don't want to do or say the wrong thing. But sometimes I think you're right. People need the good and the bad, often together. The two are never distinct, and you have to find an appropriate way to do something, and you have to be respectful in some ways. But also, you know about funerals. I interviewed somebody actually who's actually practices funerals, undertakes funerals, where often they will do the slightly more subversive things. Like if somebody wanted a more lighthearted funeral, for example, like juggling balls, you know, that sort of thing, they will do that. Now, of course, people might say, you can't juggle balls at a, you know, sort of go in a clown's outfit or something like that. But actually, it might be in keeping with the person whose life you're celebrating. So actually, I think humor in that sense is pretty much undervalued.
Yeah. Just this Monday, I went to the funeral of one of my nemeses. Yes. Okay. The man who started Regent University was Pat Robertson. Okay. Pat Robertson is known for many things. So he was there, and I was a faculty member there for 25 years. He made me president for 5 years. That was something I did not look for, but over a weekend, they appointed me president. And it was like Prince Hal becoming Henry V really fast. You know, those things just don't. I was still more like Falstaff. My friends were like Falstaff. But he and I kind of disagreed. In fact, he once wrote me a note that I have. He says, God has given me a mandate to be happy. You are not making me happy. You are not in God's will. And to me, one of the most hilarious things, but his funeral was on Monday. And one of the great things about it was his son is a friend of mine. And his son talks about being drunk up at the University of Virginia. And he turned on the TV and there was his dad preaching. And he went to go turn off the dial. And Pat said, don't touch that dial. You need to repent. And so it just really got him. His other son was in Japan and turned on the TV and saw his dad speaking in Japanese. And so these kind of comic moments made Pat even more real and made him more genuine. It made him more human. Instead of lifting some person up, you began to realize, well, let's see the people in all of their flaws, in all their foibles. There's something wonderful about seeing the weakness of other people. And so it was really kind of a great celebration.
And I think you're right. And I think that's why sometimes when people are talking about religion, and this happens more off campus, as it were, than on campus, when somebody in a supermarket will ask me what I do for a living. And then you suddenly find that, of course, people have a particular way in. We all do it. We have our own lens through which we look at the world. But often somebody will take what they think religion is and then sort of apply it to what I'm doing. So suddenly I'm responsible for all the problems they've had in their life. And I'm like, I teach religious studies in a university, and suddenly it's like, you're the ambassador. And I understand, you know, like politicians become, you know, sometimes people will say, well, you know, you're representative of all politicians, and therefore, you know, sometimes they might you know, be pretty derogatory or whatever it might be because of a particular thing that's going on. But I do find that very insightful, because when you're teaching religion in the classroom, the last thing we ever do is ask our students, certainly in a more sort of perhaps more secular context in the place where I work anyway, but you don't ask the students what faith, if any, they have. But often students will reveal it. You're more likely to reveal something if you want to reveal it when you're not being forced to do so, rather than in an environment where suddenly you, whatever you say, you're aware that you might be judged, for example. So it's that whole safe space environment. And I find what a privilege to be teaching in this sort of context, because you learn far more through not talking about religion than even if it's the subject that is, you know, they're going to get their degree in, than actually when you're in a more sort of contrived space where people might not feel quite ready to jump through those hoops.
But what I'm finding is there's almost been a change though too. As I get older, the one thing I've really discovered is pedagogy is personal. The teachers that have had the best influence on my life are the ones whose personal stories come into the classroom, where it's not just kind of this German modernity, this kind of objectivity of here's the information, take it, stuff it in your mouth and try to chew now. You can't chew all that stuff. But when the story comes out, like David Hubbard in seminary, the president there, he would talk about his wife, an invalid, and how much he loved her and how much he cared for her. And that if the phone rang or something, he would go to her. The story there stuck in my mind more than any lecture. And he was talking about Song of Solomon. And it was kind of erotic, but also romantic, and just something that was filled with sorrow as well as joy and hope. And so the older I become, the more I realize my personal story has to come in relevant ways, not just kind of to tell my stories and take up time, but in ways that kind of address people. And religion is something that my personal religion has become much more blatant. I mean, I'm brazen now compared to what I used to be, even in a religious school. Because I want to kind of make them think. And most of the time, these students aren't even thinking of anything about Jesus or anything about what the idea of a resurrection is. It's so far removed from them that it becomes a fresh story. So I can tell Bible stories. They have no idea where they're coming from. And it's so exciting. I said, I made them up. I was the one who wrote these stories, the prodigal son, you know, Good Samaritan. But the other thing is when people do come up to me like they do to you and say, oh, you're religion, you know, and here's something I have. I start talking to them. All of a sudden I go, well, wait. Okay. And I'm talking to God. They go, okay. I said, do you want me to tell you what he just told me? All of a sudden they're new, totally different people. No, really about him? No. Okay. Oh, you know what? You've got some things to sort out before you can talk about God. And he won't even hear you right now. No, I'm kidding. So there's a sense in which all of a sudden if you do become the representative of God, it shakes them up. Yeah. To say that I'm actually talking. And there was a little nun I'd met out in the early 70s. And in the middle of a conversation with her, she would just start talking, having a conversation with God. And she'd go, oh, no, I don't want to do that now. How about later? I'm talking to this guy here. Yeah. You know. And you go, wait, who else is here? And you realize if the presence of God is around, this little nun was more in tap with anything going on than I was. And it's a change that has happened to me in the last 5 years, I think, where I'm going to just try and say, hey, this is on my heart. This is on my mind. I'm going to play with these questions, see how you respond. Mm-hmm. And it's something that students are hungry for. They attend to it more than they do any kind of even good lecture. And I can be excited about film, but all of a sudden you talk about something important in life, about a miscarriage from your daughter, and how you saw a film like Sparrows, in which a baby dies, and how these are connected. They are involved in the story. Yeah. And the story kind of transforms them, because it's not just a cinematic story. It's also a personal story of how our lives have changed in different ways.
Yeah. And it makes me see my whole profession in a different light, because once upon a time, there was almost that once upon a time. So I was about to start to go down the Tim Burton path. But it's like you'd have the grand narratives, the paradigms, the theorists, the important people. And then, you know, our job was to process those and think, wow, these are wonderful people. Whereas now I think students will rightly say, hang on, we're spending all this money, you know, this person is a misogynist, or this person is a Eurocentric male from 100 years ago, great, but that doesn't really, and most of my students are female, and they don't say this, by the way, but you know, I often think, you know, that they might rightly say, why are you spending all this time focusing on these particular theorists? And so I think it's important that we reframe the kind of things that maybe once were just taken for granted.
Yeah. Well, this is really fun, because I kind of team teach with a feminist, and a really kind of a brilliant feminist. Mm-hmm. And I get in there and I say, I'm a patriarch. This is what patriarchy looks like. It's short, chubby, doughy, kind of old, gray, you know, I control your lives in so many ways, you know, and it's playing with these kind of stereotypes. But all of a sudden you break the stereotype. If you try, you don't defend patriarchy, you don't defend oppression, but you say, I'm an oppressor. I'm a professor. And this is what I do when I grade you. And, you know, and also let's look at your own life first and let's kind of sort you out to say, where are you weak? Where are you falling? And all of us together are on this journey. My greatest kind of analogy for all of this in the classroom is Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. I say, we are all pilgrims basically heading to the cathedral to kind of atone for our sins and to worship, thank God for whatever we have. But along the way, we tell our stories, and the stories are objectionable. They're vulgar. They're sexist. They're racist. Everything. But they're stories. And we have to listen to each other's stories. If we try to clean up somebody else's story, we're not listening to the story. Because the more we listen to who they are, the more we can figure out who they are. Yeah. And we can figure out who we are. So stories are like those windows and mirrors, both. I mean, you look out and you eavesdrop on somebody, but then you also kind of reflect on, okay, I've got part of this in me as well. And where am I flawed? Where am I so sinful? And it's really kind of helpful in the whole teaching process for me.
Yeah. And I've only got a couple more questions, but what you're saying is so profound, because I'm wondering what your younger self would have thought you'd end up doing. And would your younger self be surprised? It's like the Shawshank Redemption, isn't it? You know, well, what does the young man who, with all his flaws, you know, think about, you know, what sort of conversation would you have with him? But do you sort of sometimes look back and think, goodness me, who'd have thought I'd have ended up doing this now?
Yeah, not really. I don't think I had any idea what I wanted to do. Unfortunately, I think I always just live in the present. There was a great animated film called Vasha, and it's about a girl with one eye that looks always in the past and one eye that always looks in the future. Yeah. And so she always had regret or anxiety. I mean, the eyes go in two different ways, past and future, instead of just saying, what is going on right now? How can I figure out and deal with what's right here? Because it's so easy to kind of worry and be anxious for tomorrow. But Jesus, don't worry about that. And it's so easy to regret what you've done in the past. I mean, if we all can look in the past and find those really miserable moments when we needed mercy for everything we did. But fortunately, we can even look yesterday and see those things. But if we dwell on them, it's going to ruin us. It's going to gnaw inside of us. We eat ourselves up. But if we just say, okay, what can I do right now that's good, that's right, that's kind, that's beautiful, that's fun? God appears and kind of works in those times. But we all have a tendency to look one way or the other. We have Vasha's eyes that kind of take us in two directions, and we miss right now.
And you've also perfectly answered the question that I was about to ask you, which is whether you're a looking back or a looking forward sort of person. You've wonderfully preempted that question.
No, good. Okay, that was easy. That was I do. I mean, every now you get with friends. The great thing about looking in the past is when you're with friends, and you can go back. And I have a friend, Ben Frazier, who I've known for 50 years. We went to college together. And now we kind of teach together out here in Virginia Beach. And we will tell stories that when we were together, but we will tell them radically different. I mean, and he goes, no, that's not happened. I make myself look good in my story. He makes himself look good in his story. But we come and we kind of share that. But you have that kind of common past. We knew each other's parents. We knew each other's family. We knew each other's kind of girlfriends. We knew each other's problems and pains and all everything that was good as well. And so you're able to kind of bond over that. And that's why I think reading literature is so key to really kind of holding us to the past, to these people that were there. And old films we can go and identify with in ways that we can't with all the Marvel universe. I mean, the superheroes, they're really kind of artificial compared to people who kind of just suffer. Hoosiers, as a film about basketball players, is so much more genuine than anything else we've seen today.
Yeah, so much profundity and humor as well, Terry, and everything that you've said. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Chris, it's really an honor to be with you again. I mean, I've really kind of admired your work and really appreciate this time to be with you. Thank you.